crowd loud. Fist pumping, rhythm is hitting. We wanna make it clear, we ain't scared. This is the vision we want.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today on the show, Dr. Michael Parenti joins for the hour to discuss his newest book, Profit Pathology and Other Indecencies. From market crisis to market boom, from welfare to wealth care, from homelessness to helplessness, and an all-out assault on the global environment, these are just some of the indecencies of contemporary economic life that profit pathology takes on. Join us with Dr. Michael Parenti for the hour on the Project Censored Show. Stay with us.
Imagine a world without oppressive forces slaving for almighty dollar bills.
Created by the criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by taxes, while the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, and the times for the master thief. Combine, conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential. If you ain't at the table, then you're probably on the menu.
We got that
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. Today, we are joined by noted scholar, author, and political scientist, Dr. Michael Parenti. We'll be discussing his newest book, Profit Pathology and Other Indecencies. From market crisis to market boom, from welfare to wealth care, from homelessness to helplessness, and an all-out assault on the global environment, these are just some of the indecencies of contemporary economic life that profit pathology takes on. Michael Parenti investigates how class power is a central force in our political life and yet is subjected to little critical discernment. So we hope you enjoy our program today with Dr. Michael Parenti. Here is Peter Phillips to give a proper introduction to Michael Parenti. Peter?
A PhD out of Yale, internationally known award-winning author, scholar, and lecturer, and good friend. He addresses a wide variety of political and cultural subjects. He's written 25 books, Waiting for Yesterday in 2013, Faces of Imperialism 2011, God and Other Demons 2010, Democracy for the Few, which is in its ninth edition. And today we're being talked about his new book, Profit Pathology and Other Indecencies. Michael, your core theme in this book is about how profits and capitalism are filled with pathologies and indecencies that impact human beings worldwide.
Well, not just how poorly capitalism acts upon certain peoples and places, but really about how capitalism as a system, it's hard to understand sometimes how it survives. That is, capitalism, what strikes me, is a self-destructive system. It has tendencies that are brutal. There is, for instance, all capitalist systems have competition. They celebrate competition and say the competitive enterprise is really the best thing and all that. But in fact, it's murder in there. Back in 1910, this country had 13 automotive companies that all ran with electric cars. They're gone. I mean, they're wiped out, of course. The oil companies made sure of that. And so you've got a country where the capitalists kill other capitalists. Marx says this, Volume 1 of Capital, that one capitalist will kill many capitalists. They're not there to satisfy human needs. They're there to accumulate and accumulate and accumulate. And this becomes a very irrational system, a system where I try to keep you from getting any money as a worker, as little as possible as a worker, but hoping you have lots of money as a consumer to buy all these goods that this 12-hour day or 10-hour day or whatever is producing. So there are just all these kinds of things, and I discuss lots of them. I discuss the whole question of class and what we mean by class and how that has to be really sharpened, and I hope has been with this book.
Well, Michael Pareni, you just mentioned one dirty word already, Marxism, right? We're not supposed to have that kind of critique in our system. And the other is the C word
class.
That you just mentioned, right? And you start your book by talking about class, class warfare, class conflict, class consciousness.
Yeah. And class is not the same as race and gender. I mean, there is a dimension that's like that. It's a demographic attribute of class. You are middle class. You get this kind of salary. You have that and the other thing. That's one way. But class, as it's used in the study of capitalism, class is really, it's not a demographic trait. It's a very powerful line. It really means class power. And your relationship to the means of production, your relationship to wealth and power. And that's what class is all about.
So when you talk about class and monopoly capitalism or the concentration of wealth, and you mentioned the great class divide, we know now that, of course, the upper 1% are getting richer and richer daily, literally.
Yes.
Daily. And that one of the problems with that is the concentration and accumulation of capital among a very small numbers of people worldwide, and which forces them to try to find places to invest it, and they don't always have that. So this overaccumulation and underspending by the working people and the inability to buy up all the products creates stagnation and economic collapse in situations almost inevitably.
If people are not buying up these goods, when you have a recession, that means your workers are not getting paid enough to buy the goods and services that they create. And you just have this kind of problem. And it's a chronic problem. And then the state has to come in and bail them out. When you look at the kind of Fox News kind of stuff and right-wing Republican stuff about how the government is just a meddling thing and the government is inadequate. Well, I tell you, nobody uses the state more than the corporate capitalist class, that 1%. That one accomplishment we've had in the last few years is finally getting people to recognize the great divide. I mean, to think of class not just in terms of class, race, and gender and the struggles and problems of that, or how lower middle class kids or working kids have problems in school with middle class kids or this, that, and that. But looking at class as a relationship to economic and political power.
And certainly the Occupy movement gave us the mantra of the 99% versus the 1%.
Right. It was the Occupy movement that did it. And I talk about them in the very first pages about that sort of thing.
And that's so valuable. But, the subprime mortgage crisis and the housing crisis, the bubble that collapsed in 2008, was speculative capital investing and pushing prices of homes up and properties up worldwide and then selling those instruments institutionally that created that. I mean, there was so much capital that they needed to put it someplace, and that was a bubble that expanded. And we see other bubbles growing as well. There was commodities bubble, and now there's a global land bubble.
And then millions of taxpayers have to bleed and pay it back.
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly.
In fact, just happened just last month. I find myself, it's outrageous.
Would you see war as kind of a permanent bubble? Spending on war, borrowing, states borrow money.
Yeah, war has been wonderful for those who had money and investing. Yeah, it's like World War I almost, the contracts and the like and the mercenary groups. And yeah, they did a great, great time, yeah.
Well, Michael Pareni, you started out the book talking about the Tunisian and Egyptian uprisings, and then you segued to the Occupy. And you point out specifically, you say that this wasn't Occupy Capitol Hill or it wasn't Occupy Pennsylvania Avenue, but it was literally Occupy Wall Street, calling attention to the class conflicts that we have in our society. And that's really one of the big focal points of the book.
Right.
Is this issue.
And also what I was saying in regard to just a minute ago about the electric car companies that disappeared or the meat-cutting places that what we have now is Armour and Swift and one other. Well, there used to be about 20, 30 of them. They're all wiped out. While free enterprise competition is celebrated as one of the great blessings of capitalism, the truth is it really, really leads to an awful lot of waste, of killing, of destruction. Not things that would benefit the rest of us, that's for sure.
Well, Michael, your newest book is Profit, Pathology, and Other Decencies. You're listening to the Project Censored Show, Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. For the hour, we have Michael Parenti with us. You had mentioned earlier you might want to read a passage or two, or you might want to share with listeners some of these things. Do you have something pulled up you want to share with people?
Well, there is a question. I got asked by a couple of really hardcore left economists saying, what are you talking about pathology? Why are you beginning to psychologize? We try to avoid psychologizing. We don't say, oh, you know, George Bush did this because he felt insecure, and this way he would be able to. I mean, there may be some such feelings, but that isn't what determines how these things happen. So why did I use a word like pathology? It fit a nice alliteration, profit pathology, for one thing. And other indecencies, I think to get a word like indecencies in the title of your book is, you got 200 copies sold right there, you know. It really began to strike me, and it's a departure from my usual approach, but it did strike me that it is a pathology. I'll read a couple of paragraphs. Wealth becomes addictive. Its accumulation becomes an all-consuming passion. Fortune whets the appetite for still more fortune. There is no end to the amount of money the super rich might wish to accumulate. So the accumulation addicts gather more and more for themselves, more than can be spent in 1,000 lifetimes of limitless indulgence, driven by what begins to resemble an obsessional pathology, a monomania that blots out other human considerations. So the plutocrats, with their enormous fortunes, elite education, lavish lives, and global contacts, convince themselves that they are God's gift to humanity. They live amid the finer things of life, which of itself makes them feel they are the finer people. They are more wedded to their wealth than to the earth upon which they live, more concerned about the fate of their fortunes than the fate of humanity, so possessed by their pursuit of profit as to not see the disaster looming ahead. And in fact, we know they denounce those who do see it and talk about tree huggers and there's no climate change going on and all that stuff. And you have them celebrating it as it's going to open the Northwest Passage, you know. Even Hillary Clinton, I got a quote by her in here. I don't know where exactly it is right now, but she talked about how it's going to be more direct shipping, and this is going to be great. There are companies now. They're specializing in giving guidance to other corporations on what to do when the climate changes are coming, how to make money out of that. So it's crazy, you know. They're pathological. I gave the metaphor of all of us in a bus careening down at the edge of a cliff and going over the cliff, and running up and down the aisle of the bus are these guys who are selling crash belts and things of this sort, and at very high prices. I mean, they'll try to make money. There was a cartoon in the New Yorker, which I describe in here, about how a guy is at a business meeting. Everybody's sitting around, and he's talking, and he's saying, the final years, the final period we have is going to be a terrible time for the environment and everybody. But the period just before that is going to have terrific profits, and we're really going to do really well. So this is where we are. It's really, if you look at it, it's really a little crazy. It really is.
Well, and you point out, too, in one of the chapters of your book, the issues of inequality. 85 billionaires have more wealth than half the planet.
When that was published, it said 85 billionaires have the same wealth as the poorest 50% of the globe. I said, the poorest 50% of the globe doesn't have, all taken all together, their goats, their chickens, beat up car that few have and all that. None of that amounts to what the 85 richest billionaires, they have tens of trillions of dollars in personal wealth.
So we have half the population in the world like living on less than $3 a day.
Right.
Makes some of us middle class, you know, college professors and authors and things like that, we're really up in that top 10%. But we're certainly not the 1%. The gap between, you know, the 90th percentile or the 80th percentile and the 1% right. is enormous. It's bigger than anything.
Right. And the gap within, Peter, the gap within that 1% is itself growing.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, in that 1%, you now have super, super rich over those much less so.
That super class, that 1,000th of 1%, the 6,000 folks that are basically controlling close to $100 trillion worth of wealth. These are the money managers and the banks and the central firms. They don't own all that, but they certainly control and make decisions about how that's invested.
They own a lot of it, yeah. And 1%. 1% of the American population is 3 million people. You don't have 3 million people who are super rich. They're very well off. They own two houses. They may have some millions of dollars, but that's peanuts. And never before has there been such inequality among the super elite itself. Yeah, and it's
really to be in that 1% is at the bottom rung. It's really only about $700,000-$800,000 of wealth.
That's right. And you can get wiped out on that
pretty quickly. Absolutely.
Yeah,
if that's all invested in property and the property goes downhill you're out of luck.
Or your 401k becomes a 101k, that's the middle class, yeah.
Well, Michael Perrenna, you've been writing about the super rich for some time. I remember nearly 15 years ago, perhaps around there, you wrote a piece on the super rich are out of sight.
Yeah.
Right, and that piece is at your website, michaelperrenna.org. People can learn more about you and all of your books and work there. And this problem has been exacerbated. I mean, it's gone off the chart since you were talking about it then.
Right. And even then I made the point that people don't realize how rich the super rich really are, you know. They'll go down some neighborhood, let's say, up in Cambridge and look at these million-dollar homes. Or you can go right up the hill here and look up, and they're selling for, you know, $1.5-2 million. And you say, well, that's peanuts. That's not super rich at all.
Well,
the super rich have enshrouded themselves in, they'll have walls and guards and huge estates and that sort of thing.
We can certainly get into more of that later, and certainly the transnational class and some things Peter's working on with the private mercenary armies. And boy, talk about profit pathology and other indecencies. We're right now, you're listening to the Project Censored Show at Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We're speaking with author Michael Perrenna.
And, you know, there are people who will say, Oh, this is, you're ideological, I used to hear that in academia, you see, where everybody there was free. I'm sure you two are both in academia and teach. They're told to be, don't be ideological and such. But the book isn't ideological at all. I end actually by saying simply, which of these systems works better? Again and again and again, what we find is that there are things happening in the society that don't work. The reason I want public utility rather than private utility is the public utility works better than the private utility. It's a very non-ideological approach to things.
After this musical break, we'll be back talking with Michael Perrenna about the contents of Profit Pathology. Stay with us. This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We are joined by author and political scientist Dr. Michael Perrenna. His newest book is Profit Pathology and Other Indecencies. Michael Perrenna notes how big-moneyed interests shift the rules of the game in their favor while unveiling the long march by reactionaries through the nation's institutions to undo all the gains of social democracy from the New Deal to the present. And Michael Perrenna joins us in studio, and we're speaking with him about profit pathology. Michael, just before the musical break, you were making some commentary about ideology, and that your book isn't really about ideology, and you wanted to make a few comparisons or contrasts about some things from
the
book.
Yes, I take a very empirical approach. I say I'm thinking of the French trains that operate at three times the speed of Amtrak and with much more safety and with much less cost. Amtrak's always getting bailed out and then put up again, and private interests buy it and then strip it and rip it and then the public has to pay it again. Again and again, you'll find that socialism is used to protect capitalism. It's used to compensate for capitalism. And the medical industry, you know, they talk about the billions of dollars. Stop saying billions of dollars for the medical industry. It's trillions. It's really trillions. And I'm for socialized medicine because I think it would be less expensive, less abusive. I mean, the things you got to go through in qualifying for this or that or getting this service or that, it's just terrible. It's just so denigrating. So many medical decisions are made by people because of the purse and the money. They just say, no, I'm not going to go with that treatment. I can't afford it. I've heard this. So my view is what I've been doing is I'll take socialism when it works. When it works, why not have it instead of capitalism? And the extent to which capitalism works, it's a different meaning of works. It means making great profits from it, owning a pharmaceutical company and making wealth out of that company, and at the cost to the sick and the taxpayers and others. So that's the view here, is that we're not talking ideologies, we're talking pragmatic, everyday things that are happening. The medical industry, the utility companies. Why are public utilities better than private utilities? Well, you don't have to spend millions of dollars on public relations advertising all the time. Your top executives get a nice pay, but they don't get $2, $4, $5, $10 million salary. And it's affordable. You're not jacking up the rates every time you can get a chance to do that. So
well, how do you respond when they say, well, competition makes companies more competitive or more profitable because they have to be on the cutting edge?
Right. I mentioned that just earlier, just a little reference, that competition has been so wasteful and so damaging. You could have some kinds of competition. You could have people coming in and checking on how the performance of the public utility is doing. You know, you could be, if new things and all that sort of thing.
This idea, though, that the private companies are more efficient because they're private has no substantiation in fact whatsoever. Yeah.
Yeah. I gave the example of the French trains compared to the Amtrak, which gets privatized and gets fed all these sort of special subsidies and the like. And then the health medicine treatment, then there's also health insurance, which is another whole racket, another layer on top of the medical system itself. It's
which
incredible.
Costs us another 30% on top of health care above anybody else in the world per capita.
Right, right. We pay more for health care than you can take, you know.
Anybody.
Yeah.
Michael Perini, it's also another one of these profit pathologies or other indecencies that, you know, in the United States, we seem to have this economic system that privatizes wealth or privatizes what would be considered commonwealth and then socializes debt.
Right.
And that's a huge issue here that to criticize that seems to be verboten.
Right, that's exactly it. That the state and the government, meaning the taxpayers and the working poor, they will pick up the mess that's left by the plunderers and the strippers. Take schools, for instance. I'm for public education. I remember teaching at State University of New York in Stony Brook out in Long Island, New York, and students sitting there and say, "Well, but how would socialism work? How would it work?" I said, well, you're sitting right in it right now. This is a socialist school, and the quality of the faculty at Stony Brook and the quality of the students was far superior to most of the private schools on Long Island. They were. They just were. And you had to really perform pretty well to get into the state university system. Now what they've done is they're privatizing the schools by simply choking the students, leaving them in debt. They're incredible debts. They're graduating with 50,000, 75,000, as much as that, even more if you're trying for law school.
Some six-figure. And some of these, you know, some of these debts that you're talking about, over $1 trillion in student loan debts now as tuitions keep going up and full-time hires go down. Peter and I both teach at state institutions. I'm at Diablo Valley College. Peter's at Sonoma State University.
Right.
And again, it's interesting you use that story because students, you know, often when I use your book, Democracy for the Few, in my Money, Power, Politics, Political Economy class, I mean, the students really dive into it and they ask these questions. And I say, well, I said, for those of you that want to poo-poo socialism, you can get up and go to another place somewhere else and pay 100 times more than you're paying for this same class with this same kind of kind of pedagogy or what have you. You can not drive on the roads. I mean, they just start adding up the things that go on here that if we had it the way of the markets, if everything was privatized, well, of course, then only those 85 billionaires would be able to access anything.
Yeah, and you could also say, and if you want to experience the superiority of capitalism, this book by Parenti, Democracy for the Few, is the one you're talking about, is now selling for $140. And I get complaints from people saying, shame on you profiteering and selling your book like that. I said, no, I fight with them all the time to bring the price down. I keep the book at a certain size with every edition to make it be adopted and used modestly. And so it's ironic, but here's a book that's trying to talk about profiteering and plunder and inequity. And in the meantime, the book itself is being mistreated that way.
Cornel West writes that Michael Parenti is a towering, prophetic voice in American life. We need him now more than ever. And I couldn't agree more.
I had to laugh at that, though, because, he called me a towering figure. He's about a foot taller than I am.
But towering in other ways, Michael.
Oh, thank
exactly.
You.
Thank
you,
exactly.
Maybe.
It is true. It is true. And certainly you have a trail of literature and thought behind you that is impressive on any scale. Michael Parenti, in the beginning part of the book, you mention ethnicity and exploitation, a quick history of the boiling pot. Can you talk a little bit about that? What do you mean? Of course, ethnicity and exploitation we might get, but what do you mean by that and then the quick history of the boiling pot?
The boiling pot is, I'm just replacing the word the melting pot with the boiling pot, that it hasn't been a melting pot. It's been a terrible history. 12 million to 18 million native peoples lived on this North American continent up into the 1600s, early 17, and they were liquidated. I mean, that's a Holocaust that's not matched by any other Holocaust, but very unadvertised, unlike most of our Holocausts. And so I gave a sketch and outline as to what the experiences of all that was. I mean, Then there was also the Holocaust of slavery and the Middle Passage, and that I also talked about that, which isn't talked about very much. I mean, this is all part of the history that we carry and carried right down to today.
It's a history of the prophet pathology, because this is the root of the prophets, the American prophet system, slave mm-hmm. labor, and the literal theft. Right, not just the genocide, right, but the literal theft of land, mm-hmm. and the colonial governments and the U.S. government then mm-hmm. used to quote unquote give land grants to the corporate magnates, the big businesses, etc., to go ahead and develop that, and they could sell it off, they could get it free or pennies on the dollar free at the cost of millions of lives, right?
Right.
So that's something that's almost never discussed, is the way that the wealth is accumulated, and that's pathological.
Yes, you're absolutely right. You said it better than I could today. I can tell you that, Mickey. Yeah.
Well, Michael, we're really pleased that this book is written. And when I saw it, I said, we've got to get Michael on and have him talk about this prophet pathology and other indecencies. Because it really is a summary and kind of a capstone of a lot of your work. Here it is in a book that's 150 pages plus. But it's
nice big type, very readable.
Very readable, but very clear. I mean, and it's kind of concise. I mean, but it covers everything, not only ethnicity and the boiling pot, as you call it, and medical care, and a billionaires and inequalities, and a disposable planet, in terms of how these elites are thinking that, okay, I'm going to, build myself an escape capsule or something as the oil
crazy
destroys us and we, create a climate too hot to survive in. And massive sea meltings. I mean, these are things that are real,
yeah,
and facing us in our life now that we need to be fully aware of.
And we ought to think about why is it that these guys do not grasp this impending disaster? And it's too uncomfortable. It really unhinges them. It really attacks their basic interests. So they therefore think it's just not true. And as far as they're concerned, they're going to live to the end of it. If there's a water shortage, they'll get their water. They'll have, they maybe they'll have to pay 10 times more. people who are going to be harmed are us, not the guys at the top. That's when the pitchforks should come out, I think.
Well, speaking of pitchforks, again, those people that call out these inequalities, right? You had mentioned that the people at the top, this smaller than 1%, but it's also the fact that there are a lot of apologists for the 1% in our society among all the classes, even all the way down in through to the working class, about how they're just temporarily embarrassed millionaires, to riff on Steinbeck from a while back. But the idea is that people that call this out are somehow called conspiracy theorists, right? Or they're saying that, oh, well, this isn't really happening and certain people just aren't working hard enough and so forth. So we're also working against these modes in our culture to try to get the message out, because people that point out the things like you point out in your book are attacked and labeled, even in the liberal class.
That's right. And then you just remind them, these people, a lot of them are making $7 an hour. Nobody can live off $7 an hour. A growing problem in America, not much talked about, is wage theft, it's called. It's got a term. What's happening with a lot of workers, especially workers who are carted in here from Mexico or elsewhere, is they're not paid. They'll rack up hours and hours of work and just not get paid. So there's wage theft, and they're working just for food.
We're speaking with Michael Parenti about his new book, Profit Pathology and Other Indecencies, and we're going to continue to speak with Michael Parenti after this musical break. Stay with us. Michael, let's go back. I want to look at the end of the book here. I want to look at what you have in your conclusion. You end the book by talking about the disposable planet and environmentalism, and you talk about capitalism as a self-devouring beast. But you have an epilogue that you call The Next Trip, right? So when you're ending the book here, you're talking about where we're going, right? Do you want to share with the listeners a little bit about that next trip, or a little bit about how you're ending the Profit Pathology book?
Well, let's see. The epilogue, I already talked about the bus metaphor, and we have to put aside our consumerism and take action. We have to get up from our seats and place the profiteering hawkers under adult supervision. Then we must rush the front of the bus, yank the driver away, grab hold of the wheel, slow the bus down, and turn it around. Not easy, but maybe still possible. With me, it's a recurrent scenario. It should be clear to us that despite the climate deniers, there is growing restlessness and resistance on the bus. Protests and direct actions against fracking, genetic modification, toxic dumping, nuclear power, wealth inequality, and other potentially catastrophic ecological and economic abuses are growing in number. Is that just my wishful thinking, or do you guys think that it has been more so? It ebbs and flows, but in September 2014, the largest environmental demonstration in history took place in New York. Estimates varied from 400,000 marches to 600,000, according to police scanners. A massive convergence of hope and anger. A determination to not let Mother Nature and the rest of us die a furious death, to not let anyone take us over the cliff for a sack of gold.
Yes, there is a tremendous groundswell from people who are aware, who are on this bus and realize that we're careening towards the cliff, and that we do need to turn it around. We do need to, you know, take adult control of the hawkers of private capital and manage that for all human beings. And I think that's part of the core message of your book. And, Michael, we are so pleased to have you here in studio.
Well, thank you very much. Can I just say something?
Please.
One of the closing lines I have here. You'll hear, well, they don't care what we think. They turn a deaf ear to us. You hear people complain. And that's part of a feeling of apathy and powerlessness. But it's not true. I mean, they care very much about what you think. In fact, it's about the only thing about you that holds their attentions and concerns. They don't care if you go hungry, unemployed, sick, or homeless. But they do care when you are beginning to entertain resistant democratic thoughts. They get nervous when you discard your liberal complaints and adopt a radical analysis. And so I just want to point that out, that we can yet still shake them off. They're caught in their own trap, which is to abuse and suppress more and more.
That was author and scholar Dr. Michael Parenti. He joined us in studio of KPFA Radio in Berkeley, California on May 22nd. And now we'll wrap up our program with excerpts from a speech by Parenti in which he elaborated on some of the same issues that came up in our conversation. The speech was titled, The 1% Pathology and the Myth of Capitalism. It was recorded in October of 2012. And presented by Pirate Television.
I want to point out, you know, that in every class society that's ever existed, the ruling elements do not rule nakedly. They always adorn their rule with myths or themes and symbols and the like. To justify their privileged positions at the apex of the social pyramid. So the 1% spins its self-legitimating myths. As I said, no ruling class rules nakedly. All of them, they take strenuous efforts to justify their rule. I tell students when they say, oh, they don't care what we think, they ignore us and all that. I say, oh, no, no. That's the only thing they care about you. The only thing they care about you is what you're thinking. They don't care if you eat correctly. They don't care how your living conditions are. They don't care that they've built up an inhuman and irrational traffic system that's strangulating us and polluting our air. They don't care about anything. The only thing about you they care about is what you're thinking. In the morning they start, what's going to be the story today? How do we manipulate? How do we control? How do we contain? How do we influence? How do we act upon what it is that they have in their minds? Modern capitalist societies avoid telling the truth about themselves. Instead, we get those rag-to-riches mythologies, the Horatio Alger stories, myths about fair play, equal opportunity, self-reliance, freedom, liberty, all those kind of things that they feed us again and again, a system that's been so productive and so wonderful and the like. The two fundamental myths of modern corporate capitalism that I want to treat are the myth that capitalism creates a general prosperity and a well-being, material well-being. That's myth number one. Myth number two, that capitalism creates or bolsters democracy. We even hear the phrase capitalist democracies, Western capitalist democracies and the like. Let me start with the one about prosperity. Before I get into that, there's another secondary myth I want to put aside. When I'm talking about capitalism, I'm talking about giant corporate capitalism, okay? I'm not talking about mom and pop small businesses, because immediately people get up and say, well, what about the small businesses? People get together and they build a little place and they create two more jobs and two more people come in and they work and they service the community. I'm not talking about them. Mom and pop businesses are the squirrels that dance among the elephants. I'm talking about the giant multi-billion dollar corporations, the ones that are too big to fail. They get bailouts. Mom and pop, if you fail, you go down, you sink and you drown on your own. So that's what happens. Squirrels that dance among elephants get stamped on. We're talking about transnational corporations and banks. You know, Lenin himself dealt with that question. He said, 10 million small businesses count for nothing. A few giant cartels count for everything. He wasn't dismissing or thinking less of the small. He was saying, he was talking in terms of power, where the power is, who's shaping the condition of our lives, who determines the quality of the air we breathe, the food we eat, the water we drink, the kind of jobs we can have, the images we have to deal with and such. That's not mom and pop. So I want to put mom and pop aside and talk about multinational corporate capitalism. The prosperity myth, that it creates prosperity. Corporations have given us wonderful things, and wonderful for them. Consider some consumer realities. The replacement of public nonprofit rail transit systems with polluting expensive automotive transit systems involving billion-dollar highway systems, millions killed or maimed over the decades, who didn't have to be killed or maimed if we had, as LA had before General Motors bought up all the tracks, ripped them all up and made people ride buses, and then finally got rid of most of the buses and made people buy their own cars. The replacement of local organic food supplies with pesticide-ridden factory farms, genetically modified foods, antibiotic-ridden meats, shipped long distances. And there's an avalanche of disposable products, cosmetic, medical, whatever, products that keep creating solutions for things that are not problems, trying to get you, convince you that you have this need or that problem and you should buy this and have that. The history of capitalism has been a history of both great prosperity and great poverty. We often note how wealth and poverty, we often say, isn't it how unfortunate that so much wealth here with so much poverty right here, as if it was just an unfortunate juxtaposition. And in fact, it's not at all. There's a dynamic interaction between those two things. This poverty exists because of this wealth. This wealth exists because of this poverty. It's a dynamic interrelationship. The wealth of the few rests on the poverty of the many. There could not be epauci, as Cicero called them. Epauci, P-A-U-C-I, Latin it is, it meant the few, the really elite group that ruled the Roman Senate. The Roman senators as such were one thing, but that inner group, the richest, most powerful men run Roman Senate. They could not have ruled and lived the way they want unless they had slaves and proletariat, impoverished people who worked for bare subsistence. There could be no lords and ladies without serfs who labor from dawn to dusk to keep the lords and ladies in the style to which they are accustomed. There could be no corporate capitalists without workers and indentured workers and debtors and taxpayers and all sorts of other people. So there's a real relationship between wealth and poverty. I'll return to that in a minute. I just want to say something else. Do the 1%, that top plutocracy, which you know it's really not 1%. You know that, don't you? 1% would be 3 million people. It's really more like a fraction, about 0.25%. It's about 120,000 people who really compose the super rich and have the wealth of America. And when people say, whoa, you know, that top 1% has as much wealth as the bottom 30 or 40%. That's not true at all. The bottom 30, 40% has nothing. I don't know why people are saying that. Robert Reich, I heard him say that. The 140 richest billionaires have as much wealth as the poorest 75 million people. The poorest 75 million in America don't have a pot to spit in. Most of them are in debt. Most of them are maxing out on their credit cards. Most of them are just barely getting by. How are you comparing these two? What kind of a dazzling statistic is that supposed to be? But does that 1% believe their own mythologies? Yes, of course, people believe in their own virtue. Yes, of course, they believe in their own value to society. For the most part, the class propaganda they put out elevates them, justifies their worth. So why would they not believe it? They find it very persuasive. We all find things very persuasive that are flattering to us, rather things that are critical of us. You don't know what you're talking about. What do you mean? That's what you. But when someone says something that's positive, you say, "Oh, you really think so? Hey, hmm." They believe it elevates them, it justifies their wealth. So why would they not believe it? It's very persuasive because it serves their interests. They believe that the poor are the authors of their own poverty. They believe their own wealth is earned and socially useful. It creates jobs, it provides growth. They believe the free market system is the most productive and beneficial in history. They believe competing systems and reforms and government regulations are harmful and distract from the performance of the good things. They believe that government should not be a nanny state tending to the needs of the needy. Let them learn self-reliance, those people down there with their hands out. At the same time, they overlook the fact that their own class is not at all self-reliant. No one is more reliant on government handouts than corporate America. They get tax breaks more than you and I get. They get about $100 billion a year out of every budget in direct subsidies. Everything that they produce is, almost everything is subsidized by the government. They get loan guarantees. They get export subsidies. They get equity grants and land giveaways. They get almost free leases on a lot of government land to do what? Harvest the timber, or mine the copper, or drill for the oil. They get oil. They get oil giveaways practically, or leases, or the land. I mean, it'll be estimated that there's $15 billion worth of oil in a certain reserve on the government land, and they'll lease it. The government will lease it to them for like $500,000 or $1 million peanuts or something, so they can go ahead and take that. That's stealing from the public treasury. The airwaves. They get to lease the airwaves for a song. For a song. Fox News gets to get these airwaves. The airwaves, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, the airwaves are the property of the people of the United States. You'd never know it, though. They're sent out and they're used to great profit by the media corporations and their advertisers and the like. And they get bailouts. They get billion-dollar bailouts. Mom and pop doesn't get a bailout. If things go down, you go out of business, you lose your grocery store, you lose your little cafe, whatever it is. Federal government does not give you a bailout and say, hey, you're too small to fail. Let's give you some more money to boost you up here a little bit. That doesn't happen. Well, big corporate capitalism, besides being hypocritical, self-deluding, and deluding us, is also a irrational system. Marx said it was a ruthlessly rational system that demystified and shattered the Dark Ages. You know, there's that incredible paragraph in the Communist Manifesto where Marx and Engels talk about the dynamic, productive energy of capitalism and how it broke loose from the shackles of 1,000 years of the Dark Ages. And if you read, you know, the Enlightenment writers, I had a book, an anthology of the Enlightenment. I started reading them. I was so struck. I mean, I was just so struck by how naively enthusiastic they are. I mean, just the like a Ben Franklin or people like that. They were just there at the edge knowing that the world was opening up. And I said, I've got to be a little more generous to these guys. They're coming down from 1,000 years of the Dark Ages. They're coming down from a civilization that condemned the Paris medical society and the medical school in Paris for what? You know what they condemned Paris for? Empiricism. They said, Paris medicine suffers from empiricism. This was back during the time of Louis XIV, Louis XIV or so. That empiricism, that is, they were doing things like cutting open cadavers and looking and learning what the body really was about and where it was and what happened and doing that sort of thing, rather than using the Bible as its authority for judging why someone is sick, and there are four humors, there are five this, and there are seven that, and you make these old superstitious deductions, and then you gave the guy whatever it is, the eyeballs of a frog and to eat, or and he had to say 10 Our Fathers, and that would make him better. The people of the Enlightenment are coming down from that, and the whole world is opening up. And Marx is pointing out, from the late 18th century right up to his day, which is the middle of the 19th century, in that 60 years, they saw all sorts of sciences emerging. They saw continents being subdued, canals being dug, the canals then being ignored because they were building railroads now across stretches of land. And they saw this incredible burgeoning of mills and mines and all this sort of dynamic explosion. So this, Marx says, is really, a very impressive thing. It is. But it becomes irrational in its social relations. I would also add that capitalism is amazingly, amazingly irrational in regard to the environment. It explicitly ignores the environment, if you know what I mean. And it doesn't really ignore environmentalism. It condemns environmentalism. It attacks it. It has pejorative terms like tree huggers, eco-terrorists, right? Eco-terrorists, what are they talking about? They're the eco-terrorists. So they're irrational in regard to the environment. They treat the environment, first of all, they treat it and its resources as limitless, and that's incorrect. We now know most of our topsoil is almost gone, and the environment is not limitless. That's one. And they also treat the environment as disposable. It's a disposable environment. You can use up some stuff here and turn it all into wasteland and toss it aside and move on to somewhere else and do the same. Capitalism's crises are not exceptional. They are the common mode. In other words, under modern corporate capitalism, the irrational, the wasteful, the destructive, the impoverishing, all of that is the norm. Normal, balanced, productive, calm, equitable social relations and periods are the exception. Crises, panics, recession, crises again, that's the norm of capitalism. In the late 1780s, we had debtor rebellions in America. Shays' Rebellion, the best known one maybe, but others too, after the American Revolution. We had monetary crises. Then there was the panic of 1792. The panic of 1809, which lasted a number of years. The panic of 1819. The panic of 1837. Let's skip the rest of the 19th century. You can go on to the very end of the century. That decade of 1890, where the economy, the U.S. already was the leading manufacturing country in the world. And yet, that whole decade, 1890s, they couldn't pull out of the recession. They were having a tough time. Teddy Roosevelt said, we need a war, any war, let's have a war. They were looking for a war, very explicitly. War would do two things. One, it would stimulate the economy and get it going. And two, it would distract people from their economic grievances and get them flag-waving, which indeed it did with the Spanish-American War. All through the 20th century, wars and recessions, we know the 1920s as the jazz age, Charleston, oh, and things were great. The 1920s were a period of severe recession, especially in agrarian agrarian areas, less so in the cities. After that came the Great Depression, as you know, 1929, and that lasted right on up to 1941. All through the 20th century, we've had wars, recessions, inflation, market crashes, investor panics, depressions, massive deficits, bubbles and bailouts and subsidies. Hardly a normal year. When you got the free market, that market ain't so free. It is a system that can never settle with itself. The corporate crimes and crises we endure are not irrational departures from a rational system. It's not that this is an irrational time or a crazy time. It's the converse, just the converse of that. They are the rational outcomes of a basically amoral and irrational system. When you got that kind of system, this is what you're going to get. It's not that these are just some deviancy, some real bad things, or some Bernie Madoffs did this and now it's all upset and all that. No, that doesn't work. The system puts forth these people and rewards them tremendously. John Maynard Keynes, the liberal, the guru of liberal capitalism. And Keynes is looking pretty good nowadays, but it's hard to, with the free market. The free market orthodoxy prevails in much of academia in economic departments that you can't even read Keynes anymore. It makes a lot of sense. He made this point. Now, he was the guru of liberal capitalism, but he was not its shill. He wasn't its shill. He was not selling it. He was quite critical of capitalism. And he said, quote, "What an astonishing idea that the most wickedest of men," he uses a double superlative there, he uses bad grammar to be cute, to sort of emphasize the point. He says, "What an astonishing idea that the most wickedest of men doing the most wickedest of things will produce beneficial results." That's what he was saying. When the Depression came, he said, whatever could you possibly have thought was going to happen if you leave these people to be doing all this stuff? People who are not known for their human empathy or their willingness to sacrifice and share. And even if they were known for that, they seem to lose it once they get into this game. They're wedded to a system that brings poverty and hard times and attrition. Most of the world is capitalist, and most of the world is poor. Capitalist Nigeria, capitalist Indonesia, capitalist Mexico, capitalist Thailand, capitalist South Africa. I said, capitalism creates immense prosperity for a few, but it creates immense poverty. And here it is. All of these capitalist countries, they're usually not even thought of as capitalist countries, isn't that right? They're just thought of as third world countries. No, they're capitalists. The big companies that are in there, and they hire people, and they got mines and mills and whatever else. And as capitalism spreads and grows all over these worlds, so does poverty.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain.
That's an excerpt from an October 2012 speech by Michael Parenti. Earlier in the program, we featured an interview Peter and I recorded with Michael Parenti at KPFA Radio in Berkeley just a few days ago. Project Censored is heard on more than 20 stations around the U.S. To listen to past programs, go to www.projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. Anthony Fest is our producer and Erica Bridgman our engineer. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We'll see you next time.